Gentlemen, in just a few moments, we shall bring you a broadcast of an address by the President of the United States. Until that time, we present a brief musical interlude. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we take you to Washington, D.C.
December of this year, and that will constitute a record in construction for a building of this size and type. The scene of our broadcast is the southeast corner of the new building, where a platform has been erected for the ceremonies. The Honorable Frederick A. Delano, Chairman of the National Capitol Park and Planning Commission, will preside this morning and introduce the President and the Honorable Harold L. Ickes, Secretary of the Interior. The Reverend Joseph R. Sizo, Pastor of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, will offer the invocation, and the Right Reverend Patrick J. McCormick, Acting Rector of the Catholic University of America, will pronounce the benediction. The United States Marine Band is here, and under the direction of its leader, Captain Taylor Branson, will furnish the music for the exercises. Incidentally, the band is right over our heads, up on the promenade above the first floor. The outside wall of the ground floor is of pink Milford granite, as is the cornerstone, and above the walls are of cut limestone. The cornerstone bears the inscription, Franklin D. Roosevelt, President of the United States. Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury. Harold L. Ickes, Secretary of the Interior. Christian Joy Peoples, Director of Procurement. These men are still working on it, decorating, and I can't see all of the names at the moment. Neil A. Milik, Supervising Engineer. Louis A. Simon, Supervising Architect. And Waddy B. Wood, architect, dated 1935. Practically all of the invited guests are here, and they are awaiting the arrival of the President of the United States, who has already left the White House and who is expected here in just a few moments. In a specially constructed copper box to be placed in the cornerstone of this new Interior Department building, will repose a file of documents sufficiently varied to give archaeologists of the future a comprehensive close-up of official duties and civic accomplishments carried on in the year 1936 by one of the largest departments of the federal government. Approximately 3 feet long by and half that wide and 7 inches deep, the box will have as contents a Bible, a silk American flag, a pamphlet on the Constitution of the United States, a bronze medallion of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, an autographed photograph of Secretary Ickes, miniature drawings of the new building showing the architectural, structural, and mechanical details, service monographs of the Bureau of Mines, Office of Education, Reclamation Service, National Park Service, and Office of Indian Affairs. Also, an historical outline of the public land system, a copy of the Congressional Directory for the Second Session, 74th Congress. Laws relating to the National Park Service will also be in the box, as well as glimpses of our national parks, a publication of current information, and current newspapers and coins, and copies of the act approved June 16, 1933, under which funds for the building were authorized, of the latest annual report and telephone directory of the Department of Interior, and quite a list of other things will also be placed in this large copper box. And now, while we're awaiting the arrival of the President of the United States, let's hear from the United States Marine Band. Under the direction of Captain Taylor Branson, they play Hail Spirit of Liberty by Sousa.
Thank you.
now we've just been informed from persons up on the top of this building that the president is inside. He's coming down 18th Street, and just now is opposite Constitution Hall. Yes, here are the motorcycle men which are escorting him, and he'll be here at the speaker's platform in just a moment. The Honorable Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, is here. The Honorable Harold L. Ickes, Secretary of the Interior. Mr. Frederick Delano is here, ready to preside on the arrival of the President. The Honorable George H. Dern, Secretary of War. The Honorable Daniel C. Roper, Secretary of Commerce. The Honorable Charles West, Undersecretary of the Interior. And now, the applause greets the President as he prepares to get out of his open car. The president's dressed this morning in a blue double-breasted suit, and he's now left his automobile, and to the accompaniment, Hail to the Chief, makes his way to the speaker's platform. President are several members of his secretarial staff, headed by Colonel Marvin McIntyre. Now the President has taken his position, and in just a moment you will hear the invocation by the Reverend Joseph R. Sizo, pastor of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church.
Everlasting, ever-living God, in whom our fathers trusted and were not put to shame, who hath set thy glory upon this day, we thank thee that in times of crises, when the resources of men shrivel, the resources of God unfold. Hold our faces with ever increasing purpose to the assurance that that nation alone is great, whose God is the Lord. Hallow with thy presence what we do here this day. May this building bear witness to an ever increasing concern of the nation for its people, and an ever-enlarging service of government to its citizens. May thy grace rest upon all who labor here. Prosper them in their undertaking. Preserve them by thy providence unto the end of their work. Shield them from danger and accident. May all who begin the task rejoice at last in the fulfillment of their purposes. God bless our country. Give us to know that thy love falls across the busy tideways of our lives. Grant to all who lead the nation toward the more abundant life the vision of one whose hand no panic can shorten, whose light no darkness can dim. And unto thee, O illimitable love, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, shall we give all the praise, world without end. Amen.
And now the Honorable Frederick A. Delano will preside.
Mr. President, Mr. Secretary of the Interior, ladies and gentlemen, it should go without saying that I feel greatly honored at presiding at this meeting on the occasion of the laying of the cornerstone of the new Interior Department building. However, I must admit that I have only had a very small part in a very big project, and yet I am glad to record my interest in it. My contact with the project was all in its initial stages when the Secretary of the Interior asked me, as Chairman of the Park and Planning Commission, to suggest a suitable site for a building of large capacity. A number of sites were investigated, and the site chosen, occupying two city blocks between 18th and 19th Street, was recommended. It was recommended first because there are not many sites where two large city blocks can be found with an intervening street that can be abandoned. Secondly, the site was located in a rectangle where it will become an important element in a large composition, and where it will, for all time, have ample light, air, and open space about it. I claim no credit for the architecture of this building, That credit goes to the architect. However, it was with the secretary's permission that I was able to secure Mr. Waddy B. Wood. From Mr. Waddy B. Wood, preliminary drawings and estimates showing the type of building which would be advantageous in this location. And on the strength of these preliminary sketches, Mr. Wood was designated as the architect of the building, and details of the plan were worked out by him in conjunction with the procurement division. One feature of the plan to which I would particularly call attention is the economy and efficiency of the plan as a whole. Whereas it has been the custom of the government buildings in the past to occupy the entire area with large interior courts, I fully concurred with Mr. Wood's idea that this building should have no closed courts. As now being constructed, the building has neither interior courts nor any office above the ground level which does not have light, sun, air, and in many cases, a fine view. By this type of construction, Mr. Wood has secured many other incidental economies. In passing, I might say that I know an important government building not so far from here, occupying only one city block, which frequently requires one to walk two and three city blocks to call on another office in the same building. Whereas in Mr. Wood's plan, the maximum distance from one office to another will average far less in proportion to its size. This is brought about by a central main corridor which enables every office to be reached with the minimum distance. Furthermore, this central corridor plan takes care of the elevators in the most economical way, so that I venture to predict that an efficient elevator service will be secured with the minimum of expense. I would not like to give the impression here that I am indifferent to the appearance of government buildings. I have many friends among the architects, and I am an admirer of good architecture, but I am quite hostile to those architects who design buildings with little regard to the requirements of the building or the functions it is to perform. Not long ago, I had occasion to visit a very beautiful hotel in Florida built in the Spanish style. I have rarely seen a more beautiful building, but the manager of the hotel told me that after encountering heavy deficits in operation, it was necessary to spend a large sum of money in rearranging the facilities so that breakfast could be served in the rooms of guests without excessive delays and handling costs. There are ample data in the possession of the Bureau of Public Buildings to illustrate the great disparity that there is between the cost of operating and maintaining our great public buildings. Those, for example, with excessive heights of ceilings are far more expensive to maintain and keep clean than buildings of moderate heights. That is one of the reasons why ordinary commercial office buildings are often more economical to operate and maintain than the more monumental government buildings.
As a byproduct of the work this administration has obligated itself to do for the control of floods and to aid navigation, great water power projects such as Boulder Dam and the Tennessee Valley undertaking have been completed or are being developed, the energy from which is available to the people at a cost within the means of all. Reforestation and afforestation have made tremendous strides. The Guffey Coal Act represents an effort to conserve our coal supply and protect our miners. Realizing the important place of wildlife, not only in our domestic economy, but as related to the health and general welfare of the people, wildlife and bird refuges have been set up under this administration to an extent never known before. A notable start has been made towards solving the almost overwhelming problem of stream pollution. Submarginal lands from which farmers have struggled in vain to make a decent living are being purchased by the government and taken out of agricultural use. Additional areas have been added to old national parks, and new national parks have been brought into the system. And to implement his conservation policies in an effective and hitherto unthought of way, President Roosevelt conceived the brilliant idea of setting up CCC camps so that hundreds of thousands of the youth of the land, who otherwise would not be employed, might have the chance of building up their own bodies while grafting new skin to cover the scars and the burns from which our land has suffered at the hands of men and from the forces of nature. This bare recital of actual achievements is ample proof of the statement that this administration has done more to advance the cause of conservation than all preceding administrations put together. Where others have torn down, Franklin D. Roosevelt has built up. Where others have closed their eyes to reckless and oftentimes illegal exploitation, he has been alert in the public interest. Where others have done lip service to the principle of conserving our national wealth, while expressing regret that nothing could be done about it, President Roosevelt has not only found a way, he has insisted that it be taken. Having already fairly won the right to be ranked as the greatest conservationist in American history, President Roosevelt will continue to give ample proof, not only of his theoretical interest in this policy, but of his practical ability to give effect to it. Years ago, I joined the ranks of the conservationists. That was during the administration of President Theodore Roosevelt. When the present president of that name did me the honor to invite me to Washington as head of the Department of the Interior, I came as a convinced and steadfast believer in the proposition that our natural resources should be carefully conserved and prudently used in the interest not only of every American of this generation, but of every American of the generations to come. No opportunity to advance the cause of conservation has been overlooked by the Department of the Interior under this administration. While the laws of the land have been conscientiously adhered to, all questions of doubt have been resolved in favor of the public as against any selfish private interest. It always has been, and it probably always will be true, that those who stand vigilant guard over our treasures of forest and land and stream in order to protect them from the predators will be openly condemned and cunningly attacked. Notwithstanding, we must bear in mind that the true function of government is to see beyond the current month or the present year. Casting our eyes into the future, we must think of the coming generations, remembering that the imprecations that are hurled today at those who will protect our national wealth, tomorrow will re-echo as the plaudits of a grateful nation. Mr. President, whether the department that is to occupy this splendid new building, which in itself represents an outstanding accomplishment of your administration, is to be christened with the name that we would be so proud to bear, that of the Department of Conservation, or whether it is to continue to be known as the Department of the Interior. As the head of the department, I pledge to you our active support and unwavering loyalty in advancing the cause that is as dear to our hearts as it is to your own. Under your leadership and with your encouragement, every member of the staff has come to realize that all problems brought to us for solution must be considered so far as may be possible under the law from the point of view of the interests of the people as a whole, and all doubts resolved in that same interest. As is well known, while most of the major activities of the Department of the Interior at this moment are touched with a conservation interest, this new building represents much more to us than merely better and more desirable office space. It means something besides relieving the overcrowded conditions in our present building. It is to us a symbol of a new day, a turning in the long road that we have traveled since the time when the Treasury Department, with its blessing, set us forth to do a work that was already cluttering up that department in a manner that could no longer be tolerated. Let us hope that a great new adventure lies ahead of us at a significant time in the internal affairs of the United States, that a definite and final reversal of our course of heedless exploitation of our national assets is at hand, to be followed by the adoption of a policy of prudent use of those same assets, which is true conservation. To this new policy, In grateful recognition of its adoption, belated though it may be, let us then dedicate this new building. And more importantly still, let those of us who, as members of the Department of the Interior, have the great privilege of serving the people, rededicate ourselves anew to that service. In doing so, may we ever have in mind that our supreme duty is to do all that we possibly can to advance the welfare of mankind.
President of the United States.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Secretary, all of you who are gathered here today at this dedication of the first large monumental building that was started in this administration and is being completed in this administration. And on behalf of the government, I want to extend my thanks, my appreciation, to those who have taken part in the actual construction of the new Interior Department. My old friend, Waddy Wood, the architect. My old friend, Admiral Peoples, the head of the Procurement Division. And also to those who have been in charge of procuring the materials, of undertaking the contracts, and especially to the workmen who have done the job. I think that every American who loves his country ought to take to heart the earnest and sensible plea of the Secretary of the Interior for a vigorous, continuing national policy of conservation. As for myself, I am dedicated to the cause. and the Department of the Interior, as now constituted, is fully alive to the imperative necessity of protecting and preserving all of our natural resources. A nation less bountifully endowed than ours, without a national policy of conservation, would have ceased to exist a long time ago. The remarkable thing was that the people of the United States were so complacent for so long in the face of exploitation and waste and mismanagement, yes, and even larceny of the national wealth that belongs to all the people. But not everybody remained insensible to what was happening. On occasion, there came as cries from the wilderness, warnings against the ravaging of our forests, the waste of our topsoil and our water supplies, and the dissipation of our oil reserves and mineral deposits. Theodore Roosevelt, when I was a very young man, rose up and battled against this squandering of our patrimony. He, for the first time, made the people as a whole conscious that the great national domain and the natural resources of the country were the property of the nation itself and not the property of any class, regardless of its privileged status. Supported by an awakened country, which by now is beginning to realize the truth of the old warnings, we, in these later days, have devoted our thoughts and energies to the conservation of that God-given wealth, employing every agency of government to protect our birthright. We have in the past several years made advances far beyond the hopes of earlier day conservationists. But the battle goes on. And as in the case of other battles, it's a battle because there's still a lot of opposition. That battle must be carried forward with renewed vigor if future generations are to receive the full benefits that are their due. This department, the Department of the Interior, was first known as the Home Department, and it is a pretty good name. It was established 67 years ago, and since that time its activities have been intertwined with the internal development of the nation itself. I found a few days ago the report of the Committee of the House of Representatives, which favored the creation of this department.